This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
I'm Jerome Manigan. I have stories for you from the March 2011 issue of Looking Back magazine. We're starting today's program with Home Remedies. It's written by Vicki Tannabill. Remedies worth their salt and pepper. And there's an editor's note accompanying this article. The information in this article is not intended to diagnose or treat ailments. Please consult your doctor before trying any home remedies. One of my favorite heirlooms is a handwritten cookbook written by my maternal grandmother, Nora Bagley. It's not fancy, just one of those school notebooks with the black and white marbled covers, written in pencil with that exquisite penmanship that only teachers like my grandmother seem to use. The cover's missing now, and the pages are getting brittle, but it's full of wonderful recipes for things like Nora's famous date oatmeal cookies and the Concord grape juice she used to can every summer. At the back of the book, a number of pages contain household hints and the source of the hints, whether from ladies' magazines of the time, newspapers, or friends and family. One section is devoted to home remedies, many of which I remember from my childhood. I was surprised to see how many of them called for two of the most basic staples in a housewife's pantry. Simple salt and pepper. Every living creature requires salt to live, and even though Americans probably consume too much of it in their diets, it's one of the best and simplest and also one of the oldest natural remedies. The Egyptians buried their dead with dishes of salt, for example. Pepper, both the red and black varieties familiar to cooks, is used medicinally in many parts of the world, though not so much in the United States. A dark blue box of Morton salt always set out on the shelf over our stove, and I remember my mother using many of Grandma Nora's salt-based remedies. A gargle with warm salt water, 1/4 to 1 teaspoon of regular table salt dissolved in a cup of warm water, was Mom's answer to a sore throat. Use this up to 2 or 3 times a day until your throat feels better. It's also good for soothing the vocal cords during a bout of laryngitis. Some use a gargle of black pepper and warm water, but that sounds a little dangerous to me. Grandma also recommended a daily salt water gargle for keeping away colds and flu in the first place. Prevention, after all, is always the best cure. Many people use salt to keep their teeth and gums healthy. A friend who hails from England attributes his healthy set of choppers to daily use of a dentist-recommended gum treatment. He mixes 1/2 teaspoon each of baking soda and table salt and massages his gums gently with the mixture. A dentist friend of mine advocates swishing your mouth with a warm salt water rinse several times a day to strengthen the gums and get the jump on any abscesses or mouth sores. I was prone to canker sores as a child, and salt water usually did the trick. It works by drawing out fluids in the sore, helping it to heal faster. If you have a nasty canker sore or feel desperate, some people recommend numbing the spot with an ice cube and then placing a quantity of salt directly on the sore. I've tried this, and it works, but be warned, it's not for the faint of heart. Got a toothache? An old folk remedy is to take a pinch of salt and black pepper and place it on the tooth. It's supposed to work immediately, but I haven't tried it myself. Pepper is used frequently in Asia as a toothache remedy, however, so it might be worth a try. Everybody gets a cold now and then, and my doctor says the best thing you can do is use one of those saline nasal sprays available in drugstores. They are nothing but ordinary salt and distilled water, so why not make your own for pennies? Just dissolve 2 teaspoons of salt in a cup of lukewarm water and either fill a small squeeze bottle or use a neti pot. The salt water both thins nasal secretions and shrinks swollen nasal membranes. When my mom got earaches as a child, her dad would light up a cigar and blow smoke in her ear, an old folk remedy that still makes my family laugh. But he had the right idea. Earache pain responds to gentle warmth. I have a friend who likes to use a natural approach with her children, and she treats their earaches with the salt sock. She puts a cup of salt, table salt will do, but she prefers coarse sea salt or even rock salt, the kind you use in ice cream machines, in the microwave for 2 to 3 minutes. When it's warm, she transfers it to a clean sock and knots the end. The heat lasts, and the sock adjusts itself to the shape of your head. It's great for kids. A very old and effective remedy for diarrhea is equal amounts of salt and sugar dissolved in a glass of distilled water. Sucking on a lemon wedge sprinkled with salt is reputed to cure nausea and vomiting as well as hiccups. And black pepper has a positive effect on the digestion. The Chinese have used it for centuries to treat food poisoning. One of the funnier entries in my grandma's recipe book is a remedy for headaches, a mixture of chopped onions, salt, and lard, which is wrapped in a towel and applied to the forehead before retiring. I think I'll stick to aspirin. A friend of mine swears he quit a long-standing habit of smoking by putting a pinch of salt on the tip of his tongue whenever he had the urge to smoke. I can't make any promises, but it worked for him. Salt is great for irritated skin because it exfoliates, promoting healing, decreases swelling, and aids circulation. That is why swimming in ocean water helps to heal cuts and skin conditions. You can get the same effect at home by relaxing in a salt, or even better, sea salt bath. To treat ringworm, make a paste of vinegar and salt, spread it on for 5 minutes, and rinse. Ingrown hairs respond to applications. Use a clean cotton ball or washcloth of 1 to 2 teaspoons of salt dissolved in a cup of warm water. Don't rinse and reapply as necessary. Shrink boils with hot compresses of the same solution. Soaking your feet in a salt water bath, 1/2 cup salt to 1 quart of water for 5 minutes a day brings relief from athlete's foot and leaves your tootsies feeling and smelling fresh. Got the itches? A soak in heavily salted water will quell the itch of poison ivy and dry up the rash. For mosquito bites and bee stings, just moisten the bite and rub it gently with a little salt. According to Grandma Nora's book, you can treat large pores by applying a mixture of salt and buttermilk. Let it sit and then rinse. Grandma used both cayenne and black pepper for some of her favorite remedies. She made a liniment for sore muscles by boiling approximately 1 tablespoon of pepper in a pint of apple cider, not distilled vinegar. Don't strain this, but do remember to wash your hands thoroughly after applying it. Grandma's brothers went fishing on Lake Michigan every winter, and her mother kept them warm by making them wear 2 pairs of socks with a hefty sprinkling of cayenne pepper in between. I use this trick every year when I go out to choose my Christmas tree. My favorite pepper tip came not from my grandmother, but from my father's Uncle Ray. Ray was a master carpenter, and his knobby fingers bore the scars of many a sharp tool. He used to call pepper nature's scripted pencil because it stops bleeding almost instantly when applied to a cut. It works on a nosebleed, too. If you can stand the thought of snuffing pepper up your nose, have the tissue box handy. So there it is in black and white. Why search the drugstores for new and expensive products when relief might be as close as the salt and pepper shakers on your own kitchen table? Remedies Worth Their Salt and Pepper was written by Vicki Tannaville, and it includes this editor's note. The information in this article is not intended to diagnose or treat ailments. Please consult your doctor before trying any home remedies. And we're in the March 2011 issue of Looking Back magazine, and we're going to hear Winters in Buffalo, written by James Gitman. If you're over 60, as I am, you probably remember that the winters when you were a kid back in the 1950s used to have a lot more snow than they do now. I remember there being snow on the ground from October or November until April. Granted, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, known for its snowfall. We lived on a dead-end street just off Main Street on the north edge of the city. Custer Street was 1 block long, and the houses were right next to one another. You had your house and driveway, and then the neighbor's house. This made it fun to shovel snow between the houses. Every shovelful had to be carried either to the front yard or the backyard. You could climb up onto the railing of your front porch and step off onto the top of the snow you had piled on the front lawn. My father made a sort of wooden rake with a blade and a long handle. My brother and I could use this plow to drag the snow from between the houses out to the front or backyard. My father would then shovel it up into the banks we had created over the winter. Almost every house on the block had the same situation, and this resulted in piles of snow along the sidewalk that often reached over our heads. At the end of the dead-end street, there was a railroad embankment about 30 or 40 feet high. This offered a perfect hill for sledding. The last 100 feet or so of the street had no houses, so we could slide down the hill and out into the street. after a big storm. It was days before they got around to plowing the street. There was a large empty lot at the end of the street where we could play tackle football in the snow. We collected used Christmas trees in this area and built forts for snowball fights. The neighborhood was mostly young couples with children back then. There must have been 100 kids on that one block, but there were still enough older couples whose kids had grown up and moved away that you could make some money shoveling. I have fond memories of growing up in Buffalo with all that snow. I often wish that my wife and I had stayed there so that our kids could have experienced it as well. Winters in Buffalo was written by James Gitman. And we're turning to The Dented Lamp. It's written by Elva G. Turner. The garish sign in the window of the lonely little house along the turnpike announced for rent. Barren and stripped of its beauty of yesterday, the structure was hardly recognizable. Still, something compelled me to park and spend a few moments there exploring and reminiscing. I walked from end to end along the bare, narrow cement porch. Gone were the familiar rockers and the long wooden water bench that once had held a bucket of water, a wash basin, and a sardine can soap dish with its bar of yellow soap. There was no boot scraper, straw broom, or mat on the front door. A small length of rotting and broken clothesline dangled from a rusty hook like a poorly fashioned noose. "Hello," she called out as she hurried along the path. "Are you looking to rent?" "Well, not exactly," I responded. "This was my grandparents' home. Do you own it now?" "Yes, we do. It came with the farm. We live in the big house." "My mother was born in the big house," I said. "I don't want to waste your time. I'm just looking. Kind of a sentimental journey, I guess." She smiled understanding. "Here's the key. Go inside and have a look if you want to. When you're through, come on over and have a look at my restoration work." She handed me the worn old key and walked away. I couldn't help but notice it was still attached to the piece of well-polished, hard rock maple that my blind uncle had fashioned. I wandered through the empty rooms, marveling at how small they were and at how limited the interior improvements had been. Nearly 7 years had passed since my grandparents had lived there, and only a small kitchen sink and bathroom had been added. On a dusty old shelf in the cellar, I fumbled through a collection of canning jars and bottles, holding my breath as I dusted them off in hopes of finding some dated relic of the past. That's when I discovered a badly dented brass lamp base that immediately triggered a feeling of familiarity. The handle just felt natural in my hand. Coughing profusely, I attempted to brush it free of dust and kerosene, the accumulation of years. Carrying it in hand, I made my way back up the narrow, rickety stairway to a well-lighted area, and there I wiped it clean with an old rag and started polishing it with the remnants of cleanser I found by the kitchen sink. Much like Aladdin's lamp, my actions brought about a form of magic. In my mind, all was once again the same. The view from the road was a picture postcard. Peonies lined the pathway to the front door. Dahlias and asters bloomed in brilliant colors in front of the porch, and lilac trees grew close to the north wall. Beyond those was a grove of silver spruce, and just inside that protected sheltered area were the chicken coops and outhouse, each covered with the vines of morning glories in summer, but cold as an iceberg in winter. God was good when he gave chickens feathers. I can't help but wonder why he didn't give more thought to the outhouse. The coal shed and well were on the south side. Roses wrapped the well house in color. Grapevines encased the coal shed, which stored jars and jars of luscious summer fruits and jellies to feed our hungry bellies through the winter. Inside Grandma's back pantry held my favorite treats, coconut cake and ginger cookies to die for. The floors were covered with crocheted and woven rugs. Most of the chairs were well-cushioned rockers, and a fine old phonograph stood in the living room, its thick records providing pleasant music-filled evenings, especially appreciated when the winds were too gentle to turn the wind charger for the battery that would enable us to listen to the radio. I stopped polishing and stood back to admire my work, at once realizing that the character of the little house had changed drastically. The outbuildings were all gone, as was the well, and the spruce trees had long ago been cut. The lilacs were dead twigs. There were no peonies, dahlias, or vines. The rooster no longer crowed a morning wake-up. There was just this small brass lamp base with a dented side and a handle that fit my fingers perfectly. I walked slowly to the big house to return the key, still carrying the old lamp base in my hand. "Would you like to keep that?" she questioned. My finger found the small dent as I looked at it lovingly. "It's the one I always carried to my room when I stayed with Grandma." She smiled kindly. "Then it belongs to you." The Dented Lamp was written by Elva G. Turner. And let's turn in the March 2011 issue of Looking Back magazine to What's a Jackknife? It's written by Tommy C. Ferris, as told to John Sylock. A few years ago, I was in charge of a steak fry for my local service club. I knew I would be short on steak knives, so I told the guys, "Bring your own jackknives." "What's a jackknife, Tommy?" they asked. "Are you kidding me?" I laughed in disbelief. I thought they were putting me on, but it was true. No one knew what a jackknife was. "It's a folding knife," I explained simply, "a pocket knife." The day of the steak fry, some bought steak knives from home. One guy brought a hunting knife. No one had a jackknife. I thought everyone carried one. That started me thinking back to when I was a kid. I was born in 1934. For a while, I lived with my grandparents. About once a week, the Lebanese Americans who had immigrated from Beirut would meet at someone's house. When they came to my grandmother's house, the men would sit in one room and the women in another to talk. My grandmother would come in with a large wooden bowl filled with apples, oranges, or pears. The men would reach into their pockets and pull out their jackknives. They would peel the fruit while they talked. Years later, I mentioned this ritual to my Uncle Myron. He was surprised that I remembered it, since I had only been 4 years old at the time. He said that he was fascinated by the way one of the men could peel a fruit so that the narrow peeling spiraled all the way to the floor without breaking. Each spring, my grandfather and my father Jim would go into the country to search for a spring where they could find watercress growing. When they found some, they would pull out their jackknives and cut it. I wanted to be like the men, so I took out my own little knife. It was a tiny, cheap knife that I had gotten in a box of guess what? These small packages, which sold for 2 cents, contained a couple of caramel candies and a surprise. Sometimes the surprise was a tiny doll, sometimes a spinning top, and sometimes a tin jackknife. But when I tried to cut the watercress with my toy knife, the knife broke apart. I cried. My grandfather scolded me. Little men don't cry. My dad smiled. The next day, he bought me a real jackknife. If you cut yourself or throw it in the mud or scratch the furniture with it, I'll take it away from you, he told me. I treat you like a man, so I expect you to act like a man. I was proud and happy. That jackknife was my treasure. Like a Leatherman or a Swiss Army knife today, the jackknife was the all-purpose tool of its day. It is still useful for so many things: cutting weeds, cutting string or twine, cutting meat on a hunting trip, and countless other tasks. I am now 75 years old, and I still carry a jackknife. In 1957, when I graduated from college and got my first car, a 1954 Ford, my father gave me a flashlight and a jackknife for the glove compartment. Keep it there, he told me. When you need it, it's worth its weight in gold. When my sons graduated from college, I gave each of them a flashlight and a fishing tackle box with a Swiss Army knife. It has become a rite of passage and a family tradition. What's a Jackknife was written by Tommy C. Ferris as told to John Silas. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information, by Mark DeWitt.